first will be and then Australia. And after that, I'm told that National Treasury would like to table some others just for, I mean, as a prelim, which should take fairly short time. And then after that, we will deal with the other items on the agenda from National from SARS as. Why are people sitting on both sides? Okay, no, that's fine. Okay, no, that's fine. On the left we have SARS, led by Mr. Franz Tomasek, and there is Ms. Oshna Maraj. Where is she's on the wrong side. Okay, no, stay right there. Stay right there. And we also have Mr. Twala.
Yes.
Oh, okay, you're welcome. From National Treasury, we have Ms. Yang Amputa, Tax Policy, and Mr. Sado. Welcome. We are all yours on the double succession agreement.
Morning to you all. Today we'll be dealing with the ratification of tax citizens in Australia. Coming to the tax treaty ratification process, National Treasury will be dealing with the reasons for the tax treaty and the economic benefits of the tax treaty. On the other hand, Oshna from SARS will be dealing with the technicalities, the provisions of the tax treaty. Coming to the tax treaty ratification process, before a tax treaty can come into force, it has to be ratified by Parliament. That's why we are here today. Ratification can only take place after the signing of the treaty. In South Africa, ratification process is done in accordance with Section 231 of the Constitution, read with Section 108 of the Income Tax Act. It is important to know that if ratification doesn't happen, the tax treaty will never come into force. And the tax treaty presented today for ratification constitute what we believe to be the best interest of South Africa. We'll start with the Sudan SA tax treaty. The reasons for the SA Sudan tax treaty is economic relations, which will be elaborated in the next slide, the SA foreign policy into Africa, and this new tax treaty between South Africa and Sudan was signed on 7 November 2007. Looking at the trade flows between the two countries, it is important to note that the tax treaties, they assist investment flows, but it is believed that trade flows can also be grown by tax treaties, but mostly tax treaties concentrate on investment flows. The exports to Sudan were 302 million in 2004, 434 million in 2005, 453 million in 2006, and 718 million in 2007. And the main exports are machinery, mechanical appliances, plastics and rubber, and vehicles. On the other hand, imports from Sudan were 5.6 million in 2004, 632,000 in 2005, 2.5 million in 2006 and 6.9 million in 2007. From this side, you can see that South Africa is exporting more to Sudan than importing. Coming to the investment flows, at this stage, the level of investment flows between the two countries are still minimal, not even recorded by Reserve Bank yet. But so far, we've got some of the South African companies that are operating in Sudan, which includes Petro SA, Transnet, Global Railway Engineering Consortium of South Africa, and MTN Sudan. I think that's all we have for Sudan. Coming to the Australia tax treaty, the reasons for this, this is the protocol to the existing treaty. We are not doing a new treaty altogether. The tax treaty between the two countries came into force on 21 December 1999. The reason for the proposed changes to the treaty, I think we remember very well that in the 2007 budget, the minister announced changes to the STC, that we're going to change STC from company level to a shareholder level. And then those changes cannot be done in terms of domestic law up until 9 treaties have been renegotiated. So Australia is one of those countries that we need to renegotiate with. Also, the revised tax treaty doesn't only address the issue regarding the dividend withholding tax. There are other aspects that are dealt with in the treaty that were not present in the old treaty. Coming to the investment flows between the two countries. The total investment by Australia into South Africa increased from 946 million in 2003 to 2 billion in 2005. And Australian investment in South Africa increased significantly over the past decade, mainly in the mining and agricultural sectors. The major Australian investors in South Africa include mining company BHP Billiton and mining consultancy company RSG Global. Coming to investment by South Africa into Australia, the total investment by South Africa into Australia amounted to 8.5 billion in 2003 and 8.6 billion in 2005. And the major South African investors in Australia include Westbank, Pick and Pay, Woolworths, Safrand, RMD, Kumba Resources, Tiger Brands, Saki, and Marine Roberts. And the trade flows between the two countries are as follows. The exports to Australia were 7.15 billion in 2004, 9.7 billion in 2005, and 9 billion in 2006. And it is important to note that Australia is one of South Africa's largest trading partners. And the majority of goods exported to Australia are finished goods, and these include high-quality motor cars, your BMW, Mercedes-Benz, and Volkswagen. On the other hand, imports from Australia were 7.2 billion in 2004, 7.3 billion in 2005, and 9.5 billion in 2006. And the majority of goods imported from Australia are primary products such as aluminium and finished goods such as pharmaceuticals. Thank you. I'll hand it over to Oshna to do the technical provisions of the text treaty.
Good morning. This is for ratification of the Double Taxation Convention Agreement. We're doing Sudan's Double Taxation Agreement and the Australia Protocol. The purpose of the agreement is to remove barriers to cross-border trade and investment. And how can these remove tax barriers to elimination of double taxation, the certainty of tax treatment, reduce withholding tax rates, prevention of physical evasion, assistance in collection, and the resolution of tax dispute interpretation. South Africa-Sudan Double Taxation Agreement. It closely follows the OECD Model Convention, which forms the foundation for the vast majority of double taxation agreements worldwide. A number of articles are different from the normal SA approach, and these articles and other articles of interest in the South Africa-Sudan Double Taxation Agreement are as follows. Article 4, Residence. Paragraph 3 provides that where a person other than an individual is a resident of both contracting states, the competent authorities of the contracting state shall, by mutual agreement, endeavor to determine the mode of application of the agreement to that person. Now, in the absence of such an agreement by the competent authority of the contracting state, the person shall not be entitled to any relief or exemption from tax provided for by this agreement. Article 5, the permanent establishment. The term permanent establishment includes a warehouse or premises used as a sales outlet for the purposes of construction in the South African Sudan DTA, a building site, a construction, assembly, or installation project, or any supervisory activities in connection therewith. It would have to be for more than 12 months for a PE to exist. Furnishing of services, including consultancy services by an enterprise to employees or other personnel engaged by the enterprise for such purposes, a period or periods exceeding in aggregate 183 days in any 12-month period. The concept of delivery is not regarded as being of an auxiliary or preparatory nature and will create a permanent establishment. Paragraph 6 goes on to provide that activities of an agent which are wholly or almost wholly on behalf of an enterprise and conditions are made and interposed between the enterprise and agent, which differ from those which would have been between the independent enterprises, the agent would not be considered an agent of independent status. Article 9 is our associated enterprises. Paragraph 3 provides that contracting states shall not change the profits of an enterprise after the expiry of the time limit in its domestic law, or after 5 years from the end of the year in which the profit subject to such change would accrue to that enterprise. This paragraph will not apply in the case of fraud or willful defaults. It's approved. Article 10 is dividends. The dividend rate in South Africa is Sudan DT is 5% for shareholdings of at least 25% and 10% in all other cases. For Article 11, interest, South Africa Sudan DT provides for a 10% limitation. And paragraph C provides that interest arising in a contracting state shall be exempt from tax in that state if it is derived and beneficially owned by the government of the other contracting state, or political subdivision or local authority thereof, the Central Bank of Sudan, the South African Reserve Bank, or any wholly owned institution of that government or subdivision or authority. Article 12, royalties. The South African Sudan DTA, the limitation is 10%. Article 14, independent personal services. I dealt with separately in this article, and the threshold for taxation in the state is existence of a fixed base of 183 days physical presence. Article 16, director's fees. Paragraph 2 provides that salaries and wages and any other similar remuneration derived from the company in respect of the discharge of functions as an employee shall be taxable in accordance with the provisions of Article 15, which is employment income. Article 20, teachers and researchers. This article provides an exemption for tax in the host state for 2 years in respect of visiting teachers or researchers. However, the remuneration must be derived from outside the host state. Article 21, which is students and training. Paragraph 2 provides that in respect of grants and scholarships and remunerations from employment not covered under paragraph 1, a student or business trainee shall be entitled to the same exemptions, reliefs, or reductions in respect of taxes available to residents of the contracting state being visited. 25 is our mutual agreement procedure, and paragraph 4 provides that the competent authorities, through consultation, shall develop appropriate bilateral procedures, conditions, methods, and techniques for the implementation of the mutual agreement procedure provided for in this article. I'm not sure if there are any questions right now.
Just proceed to the Australian one and we'll deal with them all at the same time.
Okay, thank you. The South Africa Australia Protocol amending the Double Taxation Agreement. The articles of interest in the South Africa Australia Protocol amending the Double Taxation Agreement are as follows. Article 2, taxes covered. Paragraph 2 was amended for completeness, and the competent authorities of contracting states shall notify each other of any significant change that have been made in their respective taxation laws. Article 4, residence. Paragraph 5 of the new article eliminates the possibility of double non-taxation, which might result from domestic law exemptions in Australia in conjunction with relief under the agreement. Article 5, permanent establishment. Paragraph 2 includes agricultural, pastoral, or forestry property in the term permanent establishment. For construction, the South Africa-Australia Protocol provides that a building site, a construction or installation project in connection with such site or project must last for more than 6 months before PE will exist. Paragraph 4, activities deemed to be performed through a permanent establishment. The carrying on of supervisory or consultancy activities in connection with a building site or construction or installation project for periods or periods exceeding in aggregate 183 days in any 12-month period, or carrying on activities including the operation of substantial equipment for the exploration or exploitation of natural resources must exist for a period or periods exceeding in aggregate 90 days in any 12-month period, or operate substantial equipment, it must exist for a period exceeding in aggregate 182 days in any 12-month period. Paragraph 5 provides a rule for calculating time tick when the contracts are split between associated enterprises and activities are connected, the period during which two or more associated enterprises are carrying on concurrent activities will be counted only once in determining the duration of the activities. Paragraph 7 deems the PE to exist where a person acting on behalf of an enterprise habitually exercises an authority to substantially negotiate or conclude contracts on behalf of the enterprise or manufactures or processes for the enterprise goods and merchandise belonging to the enterprise. Article 10, which is dividends. The dividend rate in South Africa Australia Protocol is 5% for shareholding of at least 10% and 15% in all other cases. And Article 11, interest. South Africa Australia Protocol provides for 10% on the gross amount of the interest. Article 11 continues. Paragraph 2 provides that the interest arising in the contracting state and beneficially owned by residents of the other contracting state may not be taxed in the first mentioned state if the interest is derived by a contracting state or by a political or administrative subdivision or local authority thereof or by any other body exercising governmental functions or by a bank performing central banking functions, or the interest is derived by a financial institution which is unrelated to and dealing wholly independently with that payer. Article 12, royalties may also be taxed in the contracting state in which they arise, but the tax charge is limited to 5% of the gross amount of the royalties. Article 3TA is a non-discrimination article and was inserted immediately after Article 23 of the agreement. This inclusion was due to Australia now accepting such an article, and it broadly follows the OECD and UN model provision. Article 25, which is exchange of information. The new article is in line with the OECD model and provides for an extensive exchange of information. Article 25A, which is assistance in the collection of taxes. Under this new article, the two states are empowered to collect taxes on behalf of each other where the assessments are final.
Thank you. There we have it. Double taxation agreement and protocol amending the double taxation agreement. Members, and I've just been checking here. I'm informed that we have had the preliminaries on both these agreements and the protocol. The one in Sudan was in November. It's my information is correct, and the one in Australia was in August last year. Is that correct?
Where do the Australia protocol is a final ratification. You haven't done a preliminary on it.
Oh, okay. But that's the okay. Okay. Another question. Dr. George, Mr. Singh, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a question for clarity. Is that on the presentation, when we look at the investment flows and the trade flows, in the instance of Australia, investment outflow is larger than inflow, and trade is the same way. So really the flow is sort of net SA to Australia. And in Sudan, it's the other way around. So my question is, does this impact on the way that you actually structure the agreements at all? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. This is just also a general question. Australia, CD first agreement was in 1999. How often are amendments made? And the latest amendments and the latest agreement that we have on the table, does it include the recent taxation laws amendment that we put through?
Thank you, Chair. Mine is a small one. We had two presentations in this area. If you look at the Treasury one, it refers to economic relations, foreign policy, and tax. Now, when it comes to this on the economic relations side, is it in fact always economic relations per se? Because I can see the tax issue, but in respect of the economic relations, it wasn't that clear. Perhaps we can have the a sharper concept of the economic relations that we are developing between the two.
Okay, can we have a response?
Chair, actually, I've been delegated to answer the first question, so let me do so. With respect to structure, there is some impact on the direction of flow, if you like, but feeding into the second question then, one has to be very cautious about that, because treaties tend to be in place for anything from 10 to 20 years before they're looked at and revised. Typically because there is quite an extensive negotiation process and then a ratification process on both sides. So renegotiating an international treaty is not something you do lightly. So you need to have something that's going to be there for the long haul. What is more important normally with respect to a treaty is whether you're dealing with, you have a developing country or a developed country negotiation. Now, South Africa is in a very interesting position because sometimes we're the developed country and sometimes we're the developing country in comparison to our treaty partner. So that means we have quite a mix of treaties if you go and have a look at the treaties we've entered into. And your rough rule of thumb then is, where we're talking a developing country treaty, it tends to follow the UN model more closely. And when we're talking a developed country, it tends to follow the OECD model more closely. Now, those are just rules of thumb because countries may decide that, in fact, they prefer one model or the other, even though they don't strictly fall into those classifications. And that's why you'll see each treaty is slightly different because people have different takes on just how their best interests come up.
Francis, go to the first and the second. Okay, coming to the third one, you want the economic relations? Sudan. Okay. In terms of policy, the treaty promotes economic growth by providing certainty to cross-border investment. So if there is a treaty, it gives a threshold for investors to invest in another country because they know that they are certain about the tax laws of that particular country. I understand that in Sudan, at this point in time, the investment flows are still minimal. But as soon as we started negotiating the treaty with Sudan, because we negotiated about 2 years ago, you can see that South African companies started to be interested in Sudan. That shows that as soon as you negotiate a treaty, companies can have a platform as to how they can invest in that particular country because there's certainty with regard to the tax laws of that particular country. So I think maybe after 5 years, we're going to see a growth in the level of investment flows because you can see now there are about 5 big South African companies operating in Sudan.
Okay. Further questions? If none, I would want to move on with the third one.
Just a comment, sir. These treaties and agreements are brought to our committee or the parliament for ratification. I have nothing wrong, or rather I have no problem with that. Now I'm trying to imagine here a process wherein, you know, Yanga is saying negotiations in Sudan started 2 years ago, and then of course we did get a sense of what is going on. At some point, I can't remember when, because these things come in and out all the time. We also have so many, you know, other things that we need to do. And the essence, or rather the issue for me, is that we get very little, and also when we get that very little, we get it literally at the tail end of everything. and we are expected here, you know, to put a stem, you know, I don't feel comfortable with that. To an extent, you know, we might even wish either we are engaged in a workshop scenario in really getting to understand what is it that we are ratifying. Yes, you have a sense, you know, I'm thinking also on top of my head of some instances where, you know, a person comes into the country for 3 months and then goes away and then comes after, you know, well, that is equally relevant here. I would imagine so. So that person is coming to trade, you know. Now, either we have that, you know, workshop, or we are, you know, taken into confidence as the process begins and really getting a sense of what the challenges are. In that way, in my view, you are seriously on board with these processes. As we speak now, we are literally expected to put a stamp on something. I don't know. If I was to be very, you know, rough about it. I do have a sense of some of other treaties and other agreements that have come before us. More or less, the trend is one. Of course, you do have, you know, specific insofar as any country is concerned. You might wish to have challenges confronting, you know, our country as we negotiate. I thought, let me make that comment.
Okay. Can we move on? Because Mr. Johnson's concern was addressed last year. We had a workshop precisely because of the concern that members raised. We had a very thorough workshop in this committee. And that is why at the beginning of the session I reminded members when we had a prelim on Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine that that was ample opportunity for members, if they wanted more, to get more. And I do not want to subject you to our internal processes. If the committee wants a second and a third workshop, we will come back to you. Because I think that's what Mr. Johnson is saying. He's crying out for more and more workshops. And if he could just avail himself for those workshops. So yeah, it actually is not a very easy one, I must say. The reason why we had a workshop was precisely because we had that feeling, and I must admit, even after the workshop, these are very interesting, complicated matters. So we'll try and make time if it is still possible. But again, with the Australian one, I would imagine it is desirable, because when our, you know, tax system changes this side with regard to the issue of moving from the secondary tax on companies to the dividend, it's only proper that we also align that agreement with that kind of situation. I think it was quite desirable. And I must, on behalf of this committee, say that you know, with the time given to us and the volume of information that comes before us, I don't blame members if they forget that we have dealt with some of the things. I don't know whether it is possible that, you know, we dealt with it in November, whether it is possible to not give us an indication when we come towards the actual ratification, so that we can also perhaps just refresh our memories on what we had dealt with in November, because we've dealt with so many other things. Every time a final ratification has to come before us, I say to break it, to please check when we dealt with the prelim on that one, because I suspect that you guys might take a chance and do something where a prelim wasn't done, and say, but we did a prelim on this one. So I sympathize with Mr. Johnson. Okay, can I then, in the interest of progress, request that we adopt the two. Starting with Sudan. report reads as follows: that the report that the Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the agreement between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of the Republic of Sudan for the avoidance of double taxation and the prevention of fiscal evasion with respect to taxes on income, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231, Sub 2 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. Agreed. Thank you. And then Australia. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the Protocol amending the agreement between the Government of the Republic of South Africa and the Government of Australia for the avoidance of double taxation and the prevention of fiscal evasion with respect to taxes on income, recommend that the House, in terms of Section 231, Sub 2 of the Constitution, approve the said protocol. Agreed?
Yes.
Thank you. Then I'm informed that there were some prelims that National Treasury would have loved to do. I don't know, it's up to this committee whether we have adequate time to be able to look at it, but can I request that they be introduced, and if the committee feels that we would need further engagement, we would have to do that. But for now, if we could just be alerted as to what is contained in the other protocols, which one those are, and if the committee after that presentation feels that maybe we need more time to engage on those and understand them properly, we would then have to arrange that. But if not, then we will call this a prelim.
I thought it was an exam for my husband. Pardon? He's got the
freedom. We've got big worries. My apologies. Okay.
We'll be
nice. Yeah, no, they will be. Okay, and who's leading this one? Yama?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Today we are having prelims on Mexico and United Arab Emirates. Coming to the papers of the test sitting,
Members do have in their packages. If not, if you could just indicate so that Bradley and Amanda here can assist.
Okay.
Okay.
They were in the same envelope
with
the
one.
Okay, it will be Mexico, just and the United Arab
Emirates.
Yes. Just those two. Okay.
As previously stated, the purpose of the test is to promote economic growth by providing certainty to cross-border investment, and also treaties prevent double taxation of the same income through certainty of tax treatment and assignment of tax rights between the two countries. Also, in terms of administration, it assists in terms of exchange of information and mutual agreement procedure.
Okay.
Coming to the reasons for South Africa-Mexico tax treaty, the reason is for economic benefits and to increase and strengthen economic relations with the Latin American region. And also another reason for this tax treaty is the interest by Mexico to have a tax treaty with South Africa. So both countries wanted to have this tax treaty. Coming to the investment flows, the total investments by Mexico into South Africa were $5 million in 2004, $103 million in 2005, and $202 million in 2006. While investment by South Africa in Mexico were $239 million in 2004, $243 million in 2005, and $220 million in 2006. It is said that amongst African countries, South Africa is the fifth investor in Mexico. And some of the South African companies or representative offices operating in Mexico are Alexander Fox, Dimension Data, GEMCO, Anglo-American, Standard Bank, and Safro. The trade flows between the two countries are as follows. Exports to Mexico were $824.7 million in 2004, $927 million in 2005, $1.48 billion in 2006, and $1.28 billion in 2007. While imports are $708 million in 2004, $1.1 billion in 2005, $1.9 billion in 2006, and $2.1 billion in 2007. Coming to the United Arab Emirates tax treaty. The reason for this is for economic benefit and also to strengthen of relations with the countries in the Middle East. coming to the economic developments between the two countries, it is important to note that the economic development has grown strongly, taking into account that it was only in 1994 whereby we had stronger diplomatic ties between UAE and South Africa. And UAE has consistently been among the top five of the South African trading partners in the Middle East. Currently, there are about 30 South African companies or satellite offices operating in UAE. And companies such as LTA and Murray and Roberts have been involved in major construction projects in the UAE, for example, the extension of Dubai International Airport and the building of Arab Tower Hotel. Other South African companies operating there, Sasol, Middle East, Woolworths, Young Designer Emporium, Dimension Data, Multi-Choice, etc. Also, it is important to note that South African Airways has enhanced its code-sharing agreement with Emirates, which will increase the travel between the two countries. From now on, we've got, as from 30 March, we have daily flights between Cape Town and Dubai, and 3 flights a day between Johannesburg and Dubai. Also, it is said that UAE hosts the largest community of South African expat trade in the Middle East. And coming to the other side, for instance, Dubai World, which is the investment group in South Africa that represents the government of Dubai, has assisted in developing tourism in South Africa by investing in our game reserves and also waterfront DNA, waterfront hotel. The investment flows between the two countries are as follows. The total investment by UAE into South Africa was $262 million in 2004, $197 million in 2005, and $283 million in 2006. While investment by South Africa were $81 million in 2004, $76 million in 2005, and $2.8 billion in 2006. Coming to the trade flows between the two countries, exports to UAE were $2.4 billion in 2004, $2.9 billion in 2005, $3.9 billion in 2006 and $5.6 billion in 2007, while imports were $702 million in 2004, $2.6 billion in 2005, $3.9 billion in 2006 and $4.8 billion in 2007. That's all.
Okay.
Due to our constraints with time, I'm just going to go fairly quickly through the presentation and just look at the most important articles. This is our preliminary for double taxation conventions and agreements with the United Arab Emirates and Mexico. The South Africa United Arab Emirates double taxation agreement. A number of provisions are different from the normal SA approach, and these provisions and other articles of interest in the South Africa-UAE double taxation agreement are as follows. Article 1, persons covered. This was just done for completeness and updated the old article. Article 4, residents, also for completeness. Article 5, permanent establishment. The South Africa UAE GTA provides that a building site, a construction, assembly, or installation project, or any supervisory activity in connection therewith, must last for more than 12 months to be considered a PE. Article 8, shipping and air transport. Paragraph 2 provides that the interest on funds directly connected with the operation of ships and aircraft in international traffic shall be regarded as profits derived from the operation of ships, such ships or aircraft. Article 10, dividends. The dividend rate in South Africa, UAE, GTA is 5% for shareholders of at least 10% and 10% on all others. Article 11, interest. In the South Africa, UAE, GTA, paragraph 1 provides that interest arising in the contracting state and paid to resident of the other contracting state shall be taxable only in that other state, provided such resident is the beneficial owner of the interest. Article 12, royalties. In the SA UAE DTA, Paragraph 1 provides that the royalties arising in a contracting state and paid to arrangements of the other contracting state shall be taxable only in that other state, provided such resident is a beneficial owner of the royalty. Article 14, income from employment, covers international traffic. Article 70, pension and annuities. Paragraph 2 provides that pensions and other similar payments made under the social security system of the contracting state or political subdivision or a local authority or a local government shall be taxable only in that state. Article 18 is government services. Paragraph 1 provided that salaries, wages, and other similar remunerations, other than a pension paid by the contracting state or political subdivision or a local authority or local government to an individual in respect of services rendered to that contracting state or political subdivision or local authority or local government, shall be taxable only in that state. Article 19, professors and teachers, it's the standard article that we've used in other agreements as well. Article 20, students and trainees. This is merely an addition which is also standard to our OECD model. Article 27, refunds. This article covers refunds and provides that taxes withheld at source in a contracting state shall be refunded at the request of the taxpayer or of the state of which the taxpayer is a resident if the right to collect these taxes is affected by the provisions of this agreement. The competent authorities of the contracting state shall by mutual agreement settle the mode of application of this article. The South Africa-Mexico Double Taxation Agreement. There is also a number of articles that differ from the normal SA approach. These articles and other articles of interest in the South Africa-Mexico Double Taxation Agreement is as follows. Article 4, residence. Here again, we included an article which we have in a number of our other agreements, which is paragraph C, which provides that if a person other than an individual is a resident of both contracting states, the competent authorities of the contracting state shall by mutual agreement settle the question and determine the mode of application of the agreement to such person. In the absence of such agreement, such person shall be considered to be outside the scope of the agreement, except for the provisions of Article 25, which is exchange of information. Article 5, determined establishment, construction. In the South African Mexico DTA, a building site, a construction, assembly, or installation project, or any supervisory activity in connection therewith, which lasts for more than 12 months, will be considered to be a PE. And then move on to Article 7, business profits. Paragraph 1 provides that if the enterprise carries on business, the profits of the enterprise may be taxed in the other state, but only so much as is attributed to that firm's establishment, and sales in that other state of the goods or merchandise of the same or similar kind as the goods and merchandise sold through that permanent establishment. The profits derived from the sale shall be taxable in the other contracting state if the enterprise demonstrates that the sales have been carried out for reasons other than obtaining a benefit under this agreement. Article 9, Associated Enterprises, merely provides that this article, the provisions of paragraph 2 would not apply in the case of fraud or gross negligence or willful default. Article 10, dividends. The dividend rate in the South African Mexico DTA is 5% for shareholding of at least 10% and 10% in all other cases. Article 11, interest. The South African Mexico DTA provides for 10% limitation. And also provides that in Article 8 of Paragraph 8 provides that interest which has been recharacterized as a dividend will be dealt with under Article 10. Article 12, royalties. The South African Mexico DTA provides a limitation of 10%. And then something different, Article 21, the limitation of benefits. This article covers limitation of benefits and provides that a person other than an individual, which is the resident of a contracting state, shall not be entitled under this agreement to relief from taxation in the other contracting state unless certain requirements are met. The aim is to ensure that the benefits benefits apply only to genuine residents of the two countries. Article 26, assistance in the collection of taxes. Under this article, the two states are empowered to collect taxes on behalf of each other. And then lastly, the protocol. The protocol contains a number of clarifications and explanations of provisions in the agreement which are in line with normal treaty interpretation. In particular, rules of interpretation have been agreed, which ensure that a consistent approach is achieved. Are there any questions?
But those were the prelims then on the Mexican States and the United Arab Emirates. Questions, comments, and recommendations, Ms. Fabs, Mr. Marais, Mr. Singh, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I must say, it was with concern I saw the word asbestos. I'm just wondering why we are importing asbestos, considering the millions we've been paying and also the laws enacted not to include it in any construction, etc. So it would be interesting to know exactly what the purpose is for these imports of asbestos. The other issue, Chairperson, is the investment by South Africa. Notwithstanding our sort of economic partnership with UAE, I was quite concerned to see that there was a huge differential between what the UAE is putting in and what we are putting in, the difference of billions and not just millions on this occasion. The other point, Chair, is just on this one. I know the remarks, the presentation was prefaced on Mexico, that there's a number of the clauses are very particular, unique and different from others. However, notwithstanding that preface, if you look at Article 21, I think it is, the limitation of benefits, which, sorry, just one before that, which I need to look at, it was with respect to something called individual, earlier territories, Article 4. I'm just trying to work this out, Chairperson. It talks about the contracting state shall by mutual agreement settle the question and determine the mode of application of the agreement to such person. That hasn't been referred to as a unique approach, and is this then common to all of this? With that in mind, is there a relationship then between that and what was referred to as the limitation of benefits?
Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Chair. Just also for clarity for myself on the first submission, in Article 4, that's page 3, and also in Article 17, you refer to, amongst others, state itself and any political subdivision, local authority, local government, or governmental institution. What does that political subdivision mean? What does it imply? And what is the objective of that? In other words, why are you referring to a political subdivision?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. On your slide on SAUAE tax economic developments, there's one bullet point. UAE hosts the largest community of South African expats in the Middle East. Now, I don't know if that's economic development or economic regression for us. You know, we talk about skills, and I don't know if you talk about things. I know there were discussions with the UK government and South African government where they take our nurses and doctors and pay them 5 or 10 times more, and we are deprived of these skills. So I don't know how we can put it as economic development. And also whether you talk about these things when you negotiate this. So you only talk about the millions and the trillions. And on the next one, just to follow on colleague Foss, the 2.8 billion is quite a jump from 2005-2006. Can we have details of that at some stage? What are these investments in the UAE? And can we also get up-to-date figures as and when they are available? Because when you look at the $683 million in 2006 by UAE, and you read in the slide before, investment in Shamwari, Sambona, Jok Safari, etc., you would think the investment would be the other way around in terms of the amount of money. Thanks.
Okay, just a follow-up, I think, on what Naren was saying. Just on the Mexico, I'm just keen on the figures there on export and import, without really getting into any long, you know, answers to it. 207 exports, 1.28 billion, and then 2.1. I'm just keen on the... I hear here from the drone part was saying, you know, among others, the aspects of that were important. What could the other import areas that we are taking from Mexico? I'm just keen if there is any information there.
Okay,
thank
you.
With regard to investment between South Africa and UAE, the investment flows and the fact that they've jumped from 76 million in 2005 to 2.8 billion in 2006. And what happened is that in 2006, the Standard Bank Group opened a Standard Bank in UAE, and they were trading in gold. So that in 2006, I think they exported about 2.5 billion worth of gold to that bank in Standard Bank in UAE via Standard Bank London PLC. So that's why the investments were like that. So it is that single export of gold made by Standard Bank in the capitalization of Standard Bank UAE. Coming to why are we importing asbestos considering middle pay, I understand your question on that side, but for me it's difficult to comment on trade flows because that is where BTI has to comment. As President, we can comment on trade flows, but that can be followed up. Okay. Coming to the fact that UAE hosts the largest community of SA expatriates in the Middle East, and the fact that it's a regression maybe from our side. As you said earlier on, the treaty benefits the relationship between the two countries. Yes, it may be a regression, but you can see it as a gain from the other side. Also, it is important to know that, yes, they are working there, the skills are transferred from one country to another, but you can also look at the terms of the income that they are getting because they come to spend it here and their children here in South Africa. Yes, I understand your position, but the treaty builds economic relations between the two countries. We shouldn't look at this as the one-sided. And also, when we are negotiating a tax treaty, there is an article dealing with individuals and employment income earned by individuals. We also look at this issue. I think other questions staff will answer.
All right. On the question on the Article 4, the mode of application, where we're dealing with people who are not residents, who are not companies, not individuals. Essentially, one of the difficulties with applying a treaty is that somebody, the taxpayer you're dealing with needs to be a resident in one of the two countries in order to qualify for treaty benefits. And the difficulty sometimes arises with companies and other legal entities as to work out where precisely this company is resident. For an individual, it is relatively easier. We can look at where is your home, where do your kids go to school, and there's some fairly objective tests. With a company, it can be something as simple as where do the board of directors meet. And we have very good ethics with a number of countries around the world, so directors can meet in strange places sometimes. So there are different rules to work out where a company is resident, but what we've done in some of our treaties is we've said, look, where there is this confusion, it is normally because the company deliberately wants the confusion. So the two tax authorities should get together and work out where is the company really resident. And if they can't work it out, then it's resident in neither country, and it doesn't get the benefit of the treaty. Okay? Because if you have a company that has shareholders in one country, and all the directors meet in one country, and its head office in one country, it's pretty clear where it's resident. So when you start splitting up those functions and moving them around the globe, mm-hmm. things become a bit more confused, especially when we're dealing with the head office and where the board of directors are. That also feeds into the concept of the limitation of benefits article. Mm-hmm. Now, this is an article that is relatively rare in our treaties. It is something that the US is normally very keen on. So you'll find that countries that have negotiated treaties with the US very frequently think that this is an interesting idea and that they should have it in their treaty too. And unsurprisingly, Mexico is the US's southern border country. And so you have a situation where they too feel the limitation that the benefits article makes sense. Again, the idea here is to ensure that somebody isn't using the treaty in an abusive fashion, that they're just sort of stepping through a country to get somewhere else in order to access the treaty benefits. It's what's known as treaty shopping. You shop around for a country that's got a good treaty. I think those were the sort of the strongest questions that I have done. Oh, sorry, political subdivision was a question. That's typically something like a province. A province. So you'd have the national government, a subdivision, which could be a province or a state, and so you tend to try and use a neutral language here, because different countries call them different things, and then you get local government. So if you sort of map it onto South Africa, it would be national government, provincial government, and local government at the sort of municipal level.
Clarity on that question that I asked. Mr. Putra told us that I think Standard Bank, $2.5 billion rand worth of gold was sold in the UAE. Am I right?
Standard Bank has got a subsidiary. Standard Bank Group has got a subsidiary. Standard Bank London PLC. Standard Bank London PLC opened as Standard Bank UAE. So they transferred the assets, the gold, the 2.5 billion worth of gold in 2006, when they were capitalized in Standard Bank UAE. So it was from Standard Bank South Africa to Standard Bank PLC London to UAE. So it's like that. It's a transaction. But the gold was transferred from South Africa to UAE via this transaction when they opened Standard Bank UAE in 2006.
Definitely, well, that's something which we do not expect to see again. Figures might also slump again after that. Yes, Ms. Staff.
Chairperson, I'm so sorry just to take you back on one small but important point. It's all very well for us retailers to go to DTI, but I would have thought that those who crafted this agreement would know what the asbestos is for. It would be like asking where the guns are for.
But I would imagine also when it comes to registering some of the figures, it is, I mean, National Treasury is mandated to record them, but the transactions have taken place elsewhere. Because here, right, they were just given for information, these are the transactions that have taken place between ourselves and these particular countries that we are facilitating the treaties against. But also the other thing I would imagine, when treaties are signed, you might have signed a treaty with a particular objective, and either if our businesses this size do not take advantage of those, and the others are able to take advantage of them, but you've created an environment where it is possible for either side to benefit, but I'm not here to be a short steward.
The member is commenting on the trade flows. I think I've said earlier on that the trade flows, they don't depend much on tax treaties. It's investment flows that depend on tax treaties. Trade flows, there are other agreements that are regulated by DTR that are dealing with trade flows.
It answers the question technically, but I think we'll pursue it through DTI.
We now have this treaties before us. I know amongst the lots that we were given, we were also given India and Brazil. I see we haven't taken a full info, but when you come back, don't say that we have done the presidents of India. but I think it would help us also to understand why we were not briefed on those, because they were given to members.
Sure.
And I would imagine members are sitting there in their beds, and perhaps they might have done a study on them. I know members do a lot of work. They sit down and they pull out the OECD model and put it here, UN model, and see how the system do. I think we also are beginning to develop an African model. can we be advised as to why we were not briefed on the India and Brazil, and so that we can show this session?
Yeah.
Can somebody know why?
Okay. Indian Brazil was signed recently, but they were negotiated some time ago, only finalized very quickly, and were finalized so that they could sign the agreement. And therefore, we didn't get an opportunity to do the preliminary because it wasn't sort of finalized in between signature. There wasn't enough of time. So once we obtain signature, we have to do final ratification. I know that's not an excuse, but these were two important agreements because we have a trilateral agreement as well with India, Brazil, and South Africa. And therefore, there was pressure put on us so that we would get the agreement signed. And they were signed fairly recently. One was in March, and the other one was in May. Also, I think we're going to have a problem with Sudan customs as well, because that was also signed, but I don't think a prelim was done there as well. But, it's a bit of a problem, because sometimes when you want to sign the agreement, you finalize negotiations very close to when the agreement is being signed. So usually you do your preliminary first, then you do signature, then you do final ratification. And we don't have that space sometimes to do the prelim.
But sometimes, as Oshin was explaining, we do have a problem in that we run out of time between when negotiations have concluded and when signature needs to take place. So that space is where we would normally do the prelim. So before signature, after the officials have agreed the form of the treaty. In those two particular cases, unfortunately, we did not have that time. Now, as I say, that is not the desired status, because we clearly would prefer to have a preliminary briefing so that members can raise concerns and issues with what has been negotiated before the signature takes place. But unfortunately, in those two particular cases, that was not possible. Now, what that does mean is that we're obviously going to need to do a more comprehensive final briefing to you, so that you can have a proper look at it at that point, since you're going to have to do it in one stage as opposed to
but what it means is final action to signing when these agreements are not going to be of any effect until they have been ratified. Because yes, they have been signed, we haven't had a prelim, and we're now going to be having a full briefing, but the full briefing will come after signature. And I'm going to have to explain myself to Mr. Johnson after this.
I think it boils down to the administration that you have attempted. Now, what if then we disagree with some of the agreements or some of the articles that you already signed on, and the parliament disagrees with the implications there?
I would imagine parliament just wants to ratify, and then we hope that we say. I would imagine it's not a very difficult conversation. They make an option for projecting. And if you reject it, it has serious consequences, I know.
Yeah, you absolutely agree. That's precisely what happens. And internationally, you can look around. There are fairly significant agreements that countries have not ratified. One that most members will be familiar with is the United States did not ratify the Kyoto Convention. So you have situations where, between negotiation and final ratification, a government may decide that it does not wish to ratify, and then the treaty for that country does not come into effect.
So don't underestimate the power of the Namaste. If you don't have a step, it's not effective.
I just want to know about the 2-3 and the negotiations. Money spent in all this.
Whatever you spend the money, we'll have to account for it.
Exactly.
Okay, no, fine, but we'll deal with it when the time comes. But it is a matter of concern. Especially in the light of what you just spoke about this trilateral relationship between India, Brazil, and South Africa, which, I mean, formation since coming up with some benefits, I would imagine, for all of the countries, but then, you know, we're not handling matters properly, we might actually come up with some unintended consequences.
Mr. Chair, just on the unfortunate situation that we are in, if this has been signed, maybe you can give me an indication of when that has been signed, was signed, or both of them were signed. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, why is it only now that we get the first notification that it has been signed? Surely, you know, there could have been a communication between yourself and the portfolio committees to say that, you know, this is the situation that we were in. It was signed. We notify you of that. Because it clearly looks like, you know, you just want us to rubber stamp, and that would be totally unacceptable and make a laughing stock of this portfolio committee. It's actually a pity that this happens, I mean, because the committees and ourselves are full of compliments for SARS and Treasury. Mm-hmm. And just after the budget vote, now you come with this. Now we can start to criticize it again. And that this may be, you know, not playing the game. And that might make us more cautious. It might make your task a lot difficult going into the future.
Let me put that note down.
So they are implicating your job going into the future.
And the future is a very difficult one, because Mr. Malaya is actually the chairman of finance.
Yes.
Well, look, I don't know whether you'll be able to tell us when exactly they were signed, but I do not want us to deal with this, because, as I've indicated, the two processes we should not confuse. The issue of the signing and the issue of ratification. Ours is the ratification, which we have more powers than the powers to influence. Because if you have power to reject, I think that's when you have more. You really have the clout. And I know most of the time, you know, we want softer powers to be part of the negotiations, powers to be part of the influence of the process, which, of course, works well for a democracy like ours, that we're part of the process so that we always have amicable, solutions to problems. But when you have power to reject, I think that's the biggest power you can ever have. So Section 231, Sub 2 of the Constitution, lies very close to my heart.
Chair, just want to ask you, does signing not mean implementation?
No.
It's a way forward in terms of getting the final decision.
Yeah, just exactly.
Implementation lies on the Constitution, Section 231. Okay, Ms. Pop, I want us to proceed. We still have... Okay. Do Mr. Malak, you really want to have the date when it's assigned if they don't have the date coming from this? Do you have the date?
I can't remember the exact date. I doubt it. We will come back to you.
Last month.
Last month and the month before that. No, one was in February.
Okay.
It was February, March.
Okay, could we
get those details in place, so I'm sorry if my mind is not up to date correct about it, but I can get those details for you as soon as I get back to office, and I'll get them to Cindy to get to you. It was both of them, India was signed in Victoria, Brazil was signed in Somerset.
Yeah. 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 Okay, but can you finish up with those?
Yeah,
can you finish
up
with those and they will circulate them to members? And if there are any interest members, with them, would they find them?
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. That brings us to the end of the session on the establishment session agreement. We'll move on. The next item on the agenda is consideration of the special pension amendment. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Tell us which document you're talking to so that we can then move into what we're getting to. Go ahead, John.
I'm talking to the bonus tables as well as the amendment briefly discussed on Friday, which has been certified by the State Law Advisors.
Okay.
And just talk members through those again.
Okay.
As indicated on Friday, there's only two amendments to the bill that we're putting in front of the committee. The first is the deletion of the qualification in respect of criminal activity after February 1990 that would disqualify people from applying and or continuing to receive a pension. And that amendment is given effect to by, if we look at the tables bill on page 3, from line 48 to omit section 6 and 7. And then the two amendments on the proposed A bill, 2 and 3, is basically to change the numbering to ensure consistency. In the subsections are removed. The second amendment is on clause 7 of the table bill, which is on page 5, where it's proposed that the time frame within which spouses and orphans need to apply for benefits be extended to 36 months instead of 12 months, to give effect to some of the comments that raised cultural differences in respect of ability to apply or see to certain actions. So we are proposing the amendment of replacing paragraph B to provide for 36 months instead of 12 months.
Okay, so those two amendments, members, which we discussed partly on Friday. Are there any comments, any objections to these amendments in now incorporated? They have since been certified by the State Law Advisors as well. And I see in circulation also here is a list that members had requested of the Special Pensions Advisory Panel.
With
five members, and one of them
is Mr. Chuck Sokwan,
who sat before the committee.
Yeah, it's not
only about
the field board.
Okay, he has every right to like the whole parliament, he's not a member of parliament. Okay, members, comments on the amendment? Mr. Singh.
Yeah, Chair, I'm sorry about your colleague. Does the 2nd February 1991 mean that if anybody was disqualified in the first round on that basis, they will now qualify? Are you going to even look at those applications, you know, for the criminal activities? And my second question is based on what the minister said when he came to present. I mean, he harped on available resources, subject to available resources. And are we now going to be told that if we pass the bill as it is, resources will be available to deal with the new applicants that will come on board?
Okay. Thank you. On Friday, I did request a copy of the calculation. I was prompted by email that I didn't receive it, so could please get it.
Okay, response to the question, Mr. Judge. Any other questions? Okay.
I think as explained on Friday, all those people with pensions were stopped because of criminal activity will be reinstated, and there's 70 persons. In respect of those that were excluded from the first round of application, we will deal with those on an individual basis. So we're not creating a window in the legislation for a new group of persons to come in, but we are saying when people do approach the National Treasury and Special Pensions that we will indeed address people on an individual basis. In respect of the second question, in respect of available resources, Dr. George, if I can apologize, the calculation is on its way. I was hoping to have it today to also distribute to the committee, but we will, before 12 today, distribute it to Bradley just to make it available to everyone. In respect of available resources in the adjustment budget, the moment we know that Parliament is approving the legislation, provision will be made in the adjustment budget to address the additional cost and then also over the NTS period.
Questions?
Thank you, Chairperson. I must say, having been here, I was in hospital with pneumonia at one point. It's a very special bill that one of our members, Comrade Johnson, was championing. But what is my concern now is that I wouldn't want a situation, Chairperson, in which we have done this, and yet some of the people concerned do not get to hear about it. They're really so impoverished that they're not picking up a newspaper even, and unless it is as a poster in inverted commas, they may not see it. So what kind of advertising are you going to carry out to ensure that all who are eligible will see this and know that they have a claim on the state? Thank you.
I didn't look at the latest bill that they got, but there was a 6.4 billion and 6.8 billion, if you remember. In the calculation that they gave, it was 3.4, and in the bill itself, under the objective, it was 6.8. But it's still 6.86, number 5, financial implications for state. Is that going to be the financial implication, and was that other presentation wrong?
The bill before us is 6.8, I would imagine that's the figure we're talking about.
I can just respond to Honourable Member Fass. In respect of bringing it to person's attention, I think similar to running up to the 1st of December 2006 cut-off date, we will in a similar fashion have a communication campaign, and we are communicating with all the veterans associations plus the political parties to bring it to person's attention that were involved in the struggle and that could qualify. The point has been taken through the public hearing process as well that we should be doing more than what we are currently doing. So we are, the administration have taken that point on board. And I think as people report on a quarterly basis back to the committee, we'll elaborate on additional steps taken to bring it to person's attention. I think in terms of the in terms of the numbers, I think we did explain during the briefing that the number reflected in the memorandum of objects reflects currently the total cost associated with special pensions, and that the additional amendments only amount to the 3.7, which was reflected in the presentation. We did apologise on the day as well, but instead of saying it's the total cost, it indicates that it appears to reflect only the amendment. Total cost is approximately 6 billion, and then the amendment proposed here is 3.7 billion.
Yeah, I didn't want to also mention with regard to your response to the spouse's question that the committee also will perhaps some of the recommendations also have to again put in the issue of assessing the progress on a quarterly basis and have to be an indicator in order to satisfy this group of guidance and feel very important that to the committee on a quarterly basis, both of the progress being made and also on the outreach campaign as to how it's. Of course, we agree that political parties also have a responsibility also to make sure that their members actually access but also national surveillance to the party and the pension and the special pension. Third question? I wanted to take this. I see that on the board there is something already and there is some levels already. Each and together to the next.
next item on the agenda. He's responsible for problems only in the house, not here.
This
is the only time I'm able to take full charge and tell him what to do. Other than that, he's my boss. Okay, any other questions? Because I would now want us to proceed and formally consider it. If not, I then move on to the formal consideration of the
After our hearing, there were several issues that were raised by the ex-combatants association, and I think it would be important for us to acknowledge the commitment and the sacrifice that they've made to this country, and there are those who are at stake who do not qualify for special pension, and urge the House to resolve accordingly so that there are measures that are put in place. To assist them. If you see the order, the chair would propose that we table a motion before we adopt the bill.
Okay.
The motion starts that noting that former freedom fighters, ex-combatants who were 30 years old as of December 1996 and were engaged full time in the service of a political party for 5 years prior to second. February 1990 do not qualify for a special pension. Acknowledging the sacrifices and the immense contribution made by the freedom fighters, ex-combatants to the establishment of a non-racial democratic constitutional order, the House resolved that the Department of Labor should develop applied training programs for these freedom fighters / ex-combatants after a consultation with the respective ex-combatants organization. The House further resolved that the government should make available sufficient resources. The House resolved that the government meet the cost of counseling and related medical treatment for freedom fighters suffering from post-traumatic stress. The House further resolved that the government should make available sufficient resources to implement the resolution effectively. In addition, the House resolved that a system and process of regular reports to Parliament be implemented and that the first report should be made available within the first 6 months of the enactment of this amendment.
Okay, are there any objections to the motion? I think it's in line with the sentiments of the committee that we have raised here. And our motion,
yeah, Chair, we'll support that, but just in the beginning when you said Department of Labor, it is only, shouldn't be relevant government departments should assist, but in particular the Department of Labor with training. But there might be other departments that have stronger, Department of Agriculture or whatever. It just can be training or development.
Yeah,
that's
Mr. Singh, I recommend that we also spread it to other departments, but with a particular reference to the Department of Labor, because remember, we call it some of our resolutions could not be carried because they did not, or were not addressed at a particular department, and, you know, so they got lost in the process. So, you know, I think Mr. Singh's recommendation is that, you know, because he said, particularly the Department of Labor, but with other departments, there is not a lot of progress. Okay. Mr. Johnson, and then Mr. Singh.
Thanks. I think we should accept the resolution. Say for one specific question, that though you have a Department of Labor, as and when it does engage training, there are multiple guarantees, you know, talk to a job guarantee scenario that training, so that we don't train somebody only to find, you know, herself having got nowhere to go. To a point where I would insist that, despite that being the practice, we include it in that resolution. Job guarantee skills development training. The intention there is called job guarantee.
I don't know.
I'll put it to the committee because it's quite a difficult concept to training. Because what if you, I give you the training and then you still don't get it? What is the job card training? I don't know, but I'll put it to the committee and let's have a quick discussion on that. I must say I'm a bit concerned. We might actually get ourselves to some of the things played on it because we're perhaps not ambitious in the future. Any comment?
Mr. Chair, just in terms of a comment on this, and this means that this is very financial implication. So in other words, you know, first of all, if we want to guarantee a job, and secondly, if we accept the resolution, certainly it will either reallocate certain funds for the staff, and it means that other programs that the department might have planned, cannot be fulfilled totally. So is that additional funds going to be allocated or from existing funds that they must use to look at this option? Because certainly it's got financial.
Okay, Mr.
Mlatam Singwana. Well, I want to just acknowledge that indeed the program we have financial implications. But in our resolution, we are not saying to the Department of Labor, for instance, that they must then cut certain programs. We are saying government must find those resources. That means government must look for resources to fund the program that will be undertaken by the Department of Labor.
In the last comment, I want just to make a point that we on the other hand, we could not say it must be job guarantee, but it has been accredited training that they can find the jobs anyway. To say we guarantee the job, then it is the difficult.
Okay.
Yeah.
Accredited.
Okay.
Any okay, so do we then accept the motion tabled? Are we agreed? Do the motion.
Okay. Yeah, we have free health services. Something about health services. Call it after that, there was free health services.
You want
to
read?
I said the health is of the government means the cost of counseling. Which I would assume before a limited period, counseling and related medical treatment for food of vital suffering from post traumatic stress.
Counseling when necessary.
When necessary.
Very good, yeah. When necessary, very good. Yeah. Everybody will go for counseling.
Okay, then back to the bill itself, to the amendment bill itself. The motion of desirability. That in the opinion of the committee, legislation is desirable to amend the Special Pensions Act of 1996 so as to define and further define certain expressions to extend the right to a pension to persons 30 years of age but not yet 35 years of age on 1 December 1996 to extend the surviving spouse's pension offers pension and funeral benefits to certain persons, to regulate the administration of the Act and to amend Schedule 3 of the Act and to provide for matters connected therewith. Great. And then the report, the Portfolio Committee on Finance having considered and examined the Special Pensions Amendment Bill 29 of 2008, National Assembly Section 75, refers to it and classified by the joint checking mechanism of the Section 75 bill, reports the bill with amendments. Agreed?
Yes.
Yeah. Mr. Johnson, thank you very much. Let's then bring us to the end of the session.
Just one quick small one about the process moving forward. Just outside the app, you have a scenario where you have, your backlog and so on and so forth. Well, what is going to be the process, given the fact that there is no board at all, that is there?
just clarify on the way forward.
Can you check the technical today in the cloud that yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. My understanding currently is that the powers of the board have been vested with the minister, and that those powers, the minister will then decide who will then resume those powers and act on his behalf. In terms of processing, we in the special pension unit will be processing those chapters from now on. In anticipation of the new obligation that we have. So we're going to have a certain target at the end of September, October, we should be finished with all or most of the backlog. That's really the program that we currently have.
Okay, generally we're saying that you report back in terms of the motion that we are putting forward after 6 months. But I hear you on the issue of the backlog, so I think we need to have an additional one with regards to reporting back on the backlog. And I would mention the proper that you have your report back before. You say put yourself a target of September. And I would imagine that it's the proper. I don't know whether part of the sitting of September, but by September, even if we are not meeting, we would require a written report from the staff. And if the committee feels that we need to. That would be very critical for us. Because when you begin to rescind your applicants and you still haven't finalized the backlog, it would also be good for us to see whether it has the capacity and whether the capacity is really important. Okay. That brings us to the end of the special pension stamp. To those of us that have been this time for some of this. It's traditional. It's happening every. It feels like the end is not in sight. Still other challenges that we have to deal with that people are still not going to see. So, thank you very much. Okay. Thanks for sharing your research today. We'll move on to our next question. We'll wait for 10 minutes and then we'll come back because we want to finish the load. Then we'll come back and take you a bit out of the room. Welcome and good to see you again, Prof.
Chairman, thank you, Senior.
Minerals and Petroleum Resources Royal Center. Take us through your second report back, which you call the final technical review. Go ahead and
Hey, the purpose of this is that normally this process has been a little extended. And again, I wasn't sure. I thought if it's both your committee and the Minerals Committee today, but I'll attend whoever's here. I'd also like to apologize on behalf of Cecil Morton. He would have liked to have come, but he had a family crisis that he was unable to attend.
No, the Minerals and Energy Committee is represented by Mr. Sam Lowe.
Ah, okay, there we go. Yeah. That's right.
He's more than one member.
Okay, yes. No, that's right. No, we know. Okay, fair enough. Okay, just to take us through the process, just quickly, to make sure everybody's on the same page. Look, we've had a lot of versions of this bill since 2003. This is a very controversial bill from a number of angles. We've had four versions publicly released. You had the fourth version before you in March of this year. We came back in May and gave you our responses to the comments. And there, again, you'll see that the version that you have now is somewhat different than the March version. A lot of the style has changed. We tried to tighten it up technically. And what we did is, from after our meeting, we basically kept the policy in place, as we said we would, but we invited further technical comment in order to make sure the smaller issues were ironed out. Now, again, there are some who like to always insert different policy arguments. That's fair and well, but we were limiting our arguments and our position to technical at this point. We've heard the policy for quite some time. And the due date for this bill is the 24th of June. So we're getting toward the end stretch now. At least I hope we're getting to the end stretch. Now, just in terms of, I thought because the bill has changed somewhat in its format and it's been a while, that we should just take one last run through the bill so that we know what's going on here. Turning to slide 3, it's important to remember what we've done here, that we have two categories of minerals. Refined and unrefined. And the purpose of this is that to reflect basically the South African mineral processes that are currently in place. Basically, not all minerals are processed at the same state. There are different industry practices with different minerals, and what we're trying to do is reflect the current industry practice. Basically, you have refined minerals. Those are minerals that are typically refined and smelted, such as gold and silver and oil and gas, or you have unrefined, where not as much is done, they're sold in concentrate form, such as manganese, chrome, or dimension stone. Now, one thing to note in the bill, and again, I'm not sure which version has been sent around, but we have sent it out, is that there's a Schedule 1 and 2. And in those schedules, we list the minerals and what is the refined level required. Now, we have that information is still evolving. We have in South Africa over 500 minerals to be worried about. So we are putting down all the minerals that we know about and the industry is commenting on, but there are a number of places where there's smaller minerals where we're finding the smaller players aren't commenting as much, and we're going to have to refine the schedule over time. But that's where we are. Anyway, there's two overall categories which have different impacts on the bill. Now, the first thing is refined minerals versus unrefined minerals have different formulas. The formulas are the rate formulas. You will find that refined minerals get a preferential rate formula. The unrefined minerals get a less favorable formula. So it behooves the minerals to be more refined. Now, their main reason to do this is that refined minerals get less deductions. So the way it works is once you've refined, there's not as many deductions, so the formula is offsetting that lack of deductions. There's also, hopefully, a little implicit incentive for beneficiation in there. So what you see is the two formulas are basically the same, except the denominator, i.e. the dividing point, is more favorable for refined than unrefined. And what you do is you take, as a mineral extractor, is you take all the refined minerals that you have, could be gold, silver, whatever, put them together, and you apply one formula, and all the unrefined go into a second formula. And that's the basic way we do it. Now, the formulas is what changed in the earlier versions of the bill, as you've seen, and I will come back to that in a second. Now, just the last, sometimes a mineral falls under both schedules. This means that in South Africa, sometimes industry practice dictates that it will be refined, and sometimes
industrial practice is unrefined. The best example is platinum. There are key top-level players who refine their platinum and then sell it. There are other players, however, who don't have the resources to fully refine. So we've created them under both schedules, and what we've said is, if you're in the case of platinum or a dual schedule mineral, and you've reached that refined state, you get the favorable formula. If you haven't, you go the less favorable. So you're going to see quite a few of those if you look at the schedules. I think zinc is another one. But there are a few of them, and they should increase over time. Okay, now the basic formula, as I said, if you look at the first versions of the bill, when you looked at the rate, it was fairly simple. But, you know, we like simplicity academically, but when we actually come down to it, nobody likes simplicity, and so we make things more complicated. But the way the original formula went is that you just took a flat percentage per mineral. So diamond 5%, gold 3%, you know, platinum 4%. It was just these percentages by the perceived value of the mineral. And as we said to you before, that perceived value is actually wrong based on further calculations. And not that we were out of line. I think most countries use a flat. The problem with flat rates, though, is they don't take into account profitability. And so what happens is that you're overcharging when the times are bad and you're undercharging when the times are good. And what we've done here is we've taken a formula approach. Ghana actually sort of does this, and some other African countries do it, where your rate adjusts based on the profit level. Now, this is not a profit royalty, so the charge is on the gross, but the actual rate does depend on profitability, which is called the EBIT calculation, earnings before interest and taxes. And again, that was shown in the prior versions of the bill, but one of the things that we did in this bill is we try to clarify technical corrections, such as the misspelling of calculation, as I have there, which I didn't see this morning, but calculation. But you're sharing in the up and the down in things. There is also certain ceilings in the formula that says it can never go a certain percentage. So you'll see refined can never go above 5, and unrefined can never go above 7. But the key thing was is that in the comments, what's happened is the industry before wanted us to make concessions on the downtime. And we said, fine, we will compromise the royalty when the economic downturn comes. But if you're going to do that, we want more of a royalty when the economic good times come. You can't have it both ways. So that's essentially what we did. And then EBIT can never be negative, which is just a technical point that you can never have a number less than zero. So it's this adjusting formula. Now, the thing that we worked on over the last week and a half was clarifying the EBIT calculation, earnings before interest and taxes. In the prior version of the bill, I think the one that you originally saw, the earnings before interest and taxes calculation was based on accounting income. There was a lot of concern by SARS over accounting, as we've noted earlier, because they weren't sure whether they could control that. Although there was some debate whether it was more controllable. But at the end of the day, for SARS, they are more familiar with taxable income. That is what we followed. And at the end of the day, it created a number of advantages in this bill. Now, the way this EBIT calculation works is you look at the gross sales plus something called depreciation recapture to generate those gross sales. But the main one is the gross sales. That's your main input. But what you subtract is your operating expenses and your depreciation capital expenditures to produce the mineral. Now, this is all solely for the rate, not the base. So we've clarified those, and which I'll come back to in a minute. And again, the way we work is we base your deductions up to a certain level. So if you're using the refined schedule, you get your deductions up to the refined state. If you're using the unrefined schedule, you move it up to the unrefined state. So it all moves along according to that. Those have been clarified based on technical discussion. The bigger adjustments is how do you adjust this EBIT. And one of the things that we've done is we said, look, we only really want you to look at the sales of the minerals. We don't want to look at other things like your working capital income or how you're financing. We're trying to see what are you getting for the minerals themselves. So we said that no deductions for financial instruments, i.e. your passive investments and so forth. The only thing we will let you do is we will give you a deduction when you hedge the mineral sale. Oftentimes, you'll have a gold forward or a platinum forward that you're making an advance payment, effectively. What you're doing is, You're hedging your bets. You're saying the price may change over time, and we just want to lock in that amount. Those hedges will be taken into account, but nothing else. The other thing is the royalty itself. Because the formula is based on income tax, royalties are normally deductible. Here you don't want them deductible, because then what you're doing is deducting the royalty from the royalty. So you don't want that circularity. Other things you can deduct is transfer between buyer and seller. Sometimes the seller incurs transfer costs. The other thing is we don't allow excess loss carryovers as a general matter, because we're not sharing fully in the downside. However, when it comes to capital expenditure, we are willing to roll that over. So what happens is, if you have more losses than income, those lost in a year, say in 2010, those excess losses can be carried over to 2011. They're limited to 2010, except for your capital expenditure, stuff that you do for permanent investment in mining. There we let you roll over because we want you to invest in the mining industry. And what we've done is in the law is we've clarified that, and we've said all capital expenditure is normally carried over. We also clarified oil and gas, which is allowed 100% write-off, and that loss can be carried over, again, in its capital expenditure. This is one of the things, there was some concerns the gold sector had and the oil and gas sector had because of the large upfront capital costs, and effectively we are compensating for that. I think that was noted in our last discussion, but I'm just highlighting it. Give it to him, I think it went the wrong way. Those are the key adjustments. Then there's sometimes some weird situations, because sometimes you sell at an ore, a concentrate, and in that concentrate may have byproducts in it. Gold is an easy example again, because gold often comes with the uranium yellow cake byproduct, sometimes silver, platinum comes with nickel. And one of the things about the EBIT calculation is it says, okay, all the refined minerals go in one place, all the unrefined go in another. Sometimes you have a refined mineral with an unrefined byproduct or an unrefined mineral with a refined byproduct. And then what do you do then? The law clarifies that you can use any reasonable method to clearly allocate. However, sometimes if the byproduct is so small, you can ignore it in favor of the majority mineral. And you can do any one of those as long as you're consistent in your application. There's not too many of those minerals, but there are some, especially at the concentrate stage. Then what you have, once you determine the formula determines your rate. So again, that's back to your EBIT calculation. Then you apply it against the base. And as we've said before so many times for the last 4 years, this is a gross royalty. There are very few countries that use profit royalty, and I think Canada is one of the few, but there they have a lot more administration dedicated to this, and also there are concerns that the profit royalty is outside the mandate of what we were going for. We went for a gross royalty because we are in the position of a landlord. These are non-renewable mineral resources, and we want to make sure the country gets the benefit for those non-renewables. What this version of the bill clarifies, however, is how to calculate those gross sales. As a general matter, we like to see what the mining company gets, amounts received or accrued. That is the general easiest thing for SARs to administer. You look at the actual amounts, you look at the actual financials, that's easy to audit. However, there is a general override that says if the taxpayer at issue is not playing straight with us, they're not dealing at arm's length, they're trying to undermine the royalty, we can override with an arm's length principle. What's different about this and the income tax is we can override with an arm's length principle regardless of whether there's connected people or not. So it's an override. The big issue that changed as a result of comments was that we expect you to sell in a certain condition. And what we're trying to do is maintain and make sure that there's some level of beneficiation of mineral products in South Africa, that we don't just do minimal things with them and exit. So what we have here in the rules is that if you don't process to a minimum condition, then what will happen is we will gross you up to a minimum condition. Alternatively, if you do more than a minimum condition, we make sure we don't overcharge you. So for example, oftentimes you might find that you want to convert, let's say you convert ore to steel. which is the big concern by certain companies, that they will not only take that ore, refine it, concentrate it, but they will actually start doing manufacturing with it. What we want to do is make sure that that conversion of process to steel is not subject to the royalty, because the royalty is only on the mineral. It's not on manufacturing. You don't want to charge them for manufacturing. You want them to actually be encouraged to manufacture. In the version of the March version of the bill, we gave you a limited set of deductions for those things. But there was serious criticisms by the industry that says those deductions are not full compensation for manufacturing. When you manufacture, there's more than deductions in place. There's a value added. And what we've done, as we've said, is that to the extent that you do that value added, that the royalty will not be charged on the value added. Conversely, if you don't reach the minimum stage, we will add value as if you did. So we don't want people to undermine the royalty or start doing less beneficiation and they start getting rewarded for it. So that's essentially what's happening here in both sets of minerals. There's also a slightly controversial issue, but it's not significant in money, it's more emotional, is what happens with stolen, destroyed, or lost goods. Let's say the goods just get stolen. Well, we've taken the position that a royalty should still apply, because the country has still lost its non-renewable mineral resource. There was also concern with smaller players that if we allowed stolen items to be outside the system, that the smaller players might just take things away. One, there's a number of minerals that can be done. So what we've said is that if they're stolen, destroyed, or lost, there will still be a deemed charge at arm's length. That's effectively what we've done there. And that was clarified. Okay, we've done basically, there are two schedules, one refined and unrefined. That concept runs through both types, refined and unrefined, and that's what's happening in 1011. Then there are other funny things, you know. We always get back to company reorgs. I know you missed them, so we thought we'd throw them into the royalty for a little bit of extra fun. The thing that we did in the royalty is we said there was some concern that said, what happens if we sell a business and in that business it's got minerals attached? Typically the biggest worry they had was tailings. The minerals haven't even come out of the ground. They come out of the ground and are just sitting there. They said, we don't want to be charged for this because they're really not usable yet, and really we want to be able to restructure. Now the biggest thing when you have a restructuring is that most of the minerals are not going to be the driver of the restructuring. It's mostly the capital expenditure. But anyway, what we did is we provided rollover relief. We said if an entire mining business is sold or a separate division is sold, then what's going to happen is those minerals, there will be no charge. However, the party purchasing the business will be charged later on when they sell the minerals. So basically, the regime rolls over. It doesn't exempt. It just says, if I sell my business to you, you pick up the charge instead of me. And it rolls over. It's a cash flow issue. And that's typical in all of our other income tax provisions. This one is modeled after value-added tax. Then there's also issues around unincorporated bodies. Now, this one is a very technical thing. We're still struggling with this. I think the wording is mostly there, but we might be coming back to this one. And that is, oftentimes that mining companies don't just have one company owns one mineral resource right. Oftentimes they partner up. So somebody gets a 20% interest, somebody gets a 30% interest, somebody gets a 50% interest. They can do this either through a partnership or a pooling arrangement or a joint venture or any other name they can think of. And so when they put these things together, what happens under the old bill is that once you created this separate activity, the problem was it still was subject to control by multiple legal entities. So even though this separate business is operating independently, when the assets moved around this partnership or unincorporated body, they would suddenly have taxing events, even though everything was still left as one business unit. And the request was, can't we treat this unincorporated body as a separate extractor? So it's a deemed election. And what effectively happens is the separate extractor just is treated as one, separate from its members, and therefore you carry forward from there. It's much easier for SARs to enforce, it's just much easier to comply, and it creates a lot less trouble. The only problem is it's hard to draft. So we're still fixing that, but the drafting, I think, is getting closer. But that's what we've done in that section there, and we made it separate. These are old things, so I'm not going to go through them. The small business relief has remained the same. There were some concerns about anti-avoidance of small business, but we have small business relief for all of our acts. We have our appropriate anti-avoidance rules, and frankly, I think the concerns of avoidance were overstated. There's also relief for sampling this time in the bill, not in your version of the bill, but in the most recent version. We've linked the sampling relief more closely to the MPRDA. Last time it wasn't quite linked properly, we linked it a little closer. We have a general GAR. The big thing at the bottom is fiscal stability. Now, what we've had in the bill ever since the beginning was an agreement that once this royalty comes into place, that you could sign an agreement with the minister that the royalty will not increase beyond a certain point. And the reason why is mining companies need stability in order to operate, and they're making these typically 30-year investments. Now, the original fiscal stability not only gave you fiscal stability in terms of the rate, but also the base and a number of other calculations. And we had originally wanted to go that way, but because we've made so many changes over the last several months at the behest of the industry and various other players, we became concerned that if we gave a fiscal stability on the base, we might leave ourselves open. So we have limited the fiscal stability solely to the rate. We can always revisit the base later on, but we need to see how things play out first. We're just taking too many chances at this point, and the numbers have changed too much. Again, I don't think we have any plan to increase the rate. I think if you notice, our minister doesn't increase rates very often, but this bill is fairly new, and before we tied ourselves up too much, we felt that we needed to nail it down a little bit further. Then there are transitional issues. Now, in terms of transitional issues, the bill is going to be effective 1 May 2009. That's one reason why we've taken time with this bill, because we know we've had the time. And we figure let's get it right rather than rush it. So the bill comes into place for all mineral transfers on or after 1 May 2009. One of the things that has emerged with our discussions with the Department of Minerals and Energy, however, is that we thought the transition between the old order rights and the new order rights would be complete by 1 May 2009. It turns out now that a lot of mineral conversions are not going to come into place until after 2009. Now, there's a lot of arguments why this is going to happen. But one easy argument is that there are a number of people who are delaying their request for conversions. So they're only going to lodge conversions, say, in April of 2009. And the request said was, well, surely if we're not under the new order rights, we shouldn't be under the royalty. And we said, wait a minute now. What you're doing is you're delaying the implementation of the MPRDA. And now because you've gotten that delay, you want to use that delay to delay the royalty. And we said, no. We've had this debate for a while. If you remember a number of years back, there was some concern if people accelerated their conversions, they were going to be falling into the royalty. We said, no. We don't want to punish you for getting into the new regime. So everybody should go 1 May 2009. But just as we didn't want to punish the early arrivals, we don't want to give a bonus for the late arrivals. So that has been clarified in the bill. However, there are times where you might be paying two governments an old order right, a state lease. Particularly, let's say you haven't converted yet in 2009, you could still be paying the old state lease. What we've said in those cases is if you're paying the old state lease and the new royalty, we'll give you a credit so there's no double charge. So that's the offset for the double charge. The only thing to note is, again, it goes back to precious stones, that the one thing we do not give credit for is things under the Precious Stones Act, because according to the Department of Minerals and Energy, those are profit-sharing arrangements, where government really owns 70% of the mine. So there, we're not going to give a royalty offset, because government is going to be charged on its 70, the private sector will be charged on its 30. So there is no relief in those cases. The last issue here is always administration. what we've done is, because we've linked everything more closely to the income tax, the new bill is based on a yearly system, and we've linked it under basically their old income tax system. So what's going to happen now is on administration, there'll be an estimated payment the first 6 months, then the second 6 months is the second estimated payment, and then there's a final payment due 6 months after the close of the year. We've been careful about the penalty. We give a penalty only if you have a shortfall by 20% toward the end. And that's the essence of the administration, except for one other note, and that is what is unique to this bill is that normally it is SARS only that has the power to request taxpayer-specific information from taxpayers. In this bill, we've given the minister the power to request information from taxpayers on a taxpayer-by-taxpayer basis. And the reason why we've done this is we want to monitor the impact of this bill. And so we don't have any plans. We just want to make sure that there isn't any unintended consequence. And it could be to the industry's detriment. Well, you see, those you'll get fairly easy. But if people are escaping the royalty, they tend not to come forward as much. So you kind of need to get some assistance in that regard. So there, the Treasury has the power to request additional information. And that is the essence of the revised version of the bill.
Okay.
Thanks, Chief. That's it on the minerals and petroleum resources royalty bill. Are there any questions, comments? Mr. Singh? Mr. Lowe?
Yeah, thank you. Just on this transitional rule, slide 14, where you've got consideration paid to the state for old order rights can act as an offset. Now, we spoke about trusts before, the Menakwalan Trust and the Ngonyama Trust and things like that. And when I attended a presentation of the Ngonyama Trust, I found that almost 10 million rand of their income is from these lease rights. Now, they are a trust that's partly subsidized by the state through the Department of Agriculture and Land Defense. What happens in that case? Because I know they did make a submission as well here, and there were comments, but what really happened?
Okay. Mr. Lowe?
My apologies. Jefferson, I just want to know the mine dump is presently a big issue. Mining companies used to go and previously when the coal price was very low, they just left it as waste on the mine. But now, it's a reverse issue. They apply for conversion and go and mine those dumps. Now, under which category does it fall under refined minerals or unrefined minerals, the mine dumps? Then, Chair, the no deduction of the royalty itself, Chairperson, and we know that previously there was this big issue of community trust paying double royalties. I just want to know, does that no deduction of royalties to avoid circulation, does that address the issue of those communities, especially the rural communities where I am from? Jefferson, on oil and gas, the limit to that is 100% write-off. Now, Chair, if you go into Africa, I had the privilege to attend one of the conferences. You know, I travel a lot. I just want to know, Chair, why is there a write-off on the oil and gas? 100%, Papa. It means it's total write-off. There's no royalty charge for it. Why? Can I get an explanation? Chair. Then on the sampling relief chapter. That too, Chair. The exemption for sampling. Does it mean that there's an exemption on prospecting of the specific mineral as at stake now? Thank you, Chair.
Prof.
Okay, the first
I allowed Mr. Lowe to ask many questions because he represents the committee.
We would expect otherwise from Mr. Lowe. So that's fine. Let me. There are a number of issues that both Mr. Singh and Mr. Lowe raised, which I think remain difficult issues. The royalty, this bill has triggered a number of different double royalty issues. Okay? The double royalty issues that we're talking about are simply the issues that under current law, even before the royalty, there's a number of royalties that are currently paid to the state for the benefit of the state. To the extent those royalties are going on, we are giving relief. The issues that both of you are getting at are the issues of the communities. Now, the communities, this bill doesn't deal with that. And this keeps coming back. Item 11 of the MPRDA preserves the power of the communities to collect royalties to the extent they collected them before. The issue that came up is the many mining houses wanted an offset for that. And we had a problem with that in Treasury because that was effectively amounting to an earmarked royalty. So in none of the versions of the royalty bill do we allow an offset for traditional communities. Now I'm going to get back to another question on traditional communities in a minute. So the mining houses do not get relief just because they're paying a traditional community royalty. However, what we encouraged them to do was to convert their rights with the local community into an equity interest, and the biggest one being Bapa King pursued that approach, and that knocked out a big chunk of the issue right there. And they ended up actually squaring out their deal rather well. So from the mining house's point of view, we did give them a little income tax relief to say that when you enter into one of these conversions, you'll effectively get a deduction as if you were paying a royalty all along. So you get an income tax deduction there, but not on the royalty itself. The question that's really more fundamental to both questions is, what about the ongoing community royalties? How does this bill address that? Now this bill is a tax bill on the industry. It is not a bill that can preserve or adjust royalties. That's not community royalties. I mean, the tax department, we only impose tax charges on private individuals. We do not give rights out. That's more of a Department of Minerals and Energy MPRDA issue. Now, the MPRDA has preserved the rights through Item 11. So those continue. What gets tricky is that a lot of these state leases have sort of an indirect charge, and that's the one that you're talking about, where the state gets the money and has promised the money over to the community. That is an issue that isn't dealt with in this bill at all. It's not part of this bill, because that's not what this bill is about. But that issue is an important issue, especially the one you're raising. And what we have to figure out, and there is discussions about what to do with the royalty proceeds. So to the extent the government is getting a royalty, that some of the money needs to go back to the community. Now that is dealing with our public finance group, and there is discussion underway as to what to do with the royalty proceeds. But that's not something that's an object for this bill. That's really a discussion and dialogue with the Department of Finance, which I think has to be ongoing. And the difficulty we keep having with you is that is outside of Cecil's and my control. We are not... That is not our department. We have raised it with a group of public finance. We said, look, the royalty is raising a number of very significant issues here that we need to address. And I think they've acknowledged that, and we need to take that process forward, and I would encourage that we do take that process forward. But that is outside the scope of the bill. Because the last thing you want is the communities to find that they were getting an old state lease, and the government was quietly and implicitly promising money over. And then afterward, the money just falls off. and that we have highlighted, but it is not the subject of this bill. This bill is a standard tax bill, and it says this is how we're going to raise the revenue. Anyway, we'll come back to this point in a minute. There are issues about the mine dumps that Mr. Lowe raised, which is a very controversial issue. At the moment, this bill does not deal with the mine dumps, but, and the reason why, is that it's outside the scope of the MPRDA. The MPRDA doesn't regulate the mine dumps according to that case they lost. However, we understand the MPRDA is going to be amended. Now, if the MPRDA is amended to cover the mine dumps, our act will automatically tax the mine dumps. So as soon as the MPRDA resolves the issue on that side, we will tax the mine dumps, and that's that. And the royalty will apply in full. Now, the mine dump is basically when you transfer the mineral. So it depends whether the mineral is transferred in an unrefined or refined state. So they most likely will be in the unrefined condition, but you have to see what happens in the mineral. Basically, what we plan to do is treat mine dumps just like any other mineral. We're just held back because the MPRD is outside of that scope, and our bill only builds off of the MPRDA. But my understanding is you guys will be amending that, and when you do, we'll automatically follow. We will have no amendment required. There was two other issues. One was on prospect.
Are you saying that that would then require an amendment of this to cover that, or it would automatically be covered by that?
Automatically. So the moment the MPRDA is changed, we charge the royalty, and that's it. We design the royalty in such a way that it automatically follows. So that's what I hope. That's what my drafters tell me, and I'll check it again. You know, that that should happen automatically. So that's the way it should work. Otherwise, I will see you by February. but we will make sure it's covered. But I do believe it's automatic. That was the plan. The other two issues that were there, one is prospecting. What we've done is we've limited our exemption to what is in the MPRDA. The MPRDA limits the exemption to sampling. They have a special rule for sampling, testing, assaying, for both prospecting purposes and exploration purposes. So to the extent the MPRDA is granting relief for that limited category, then we will grant relief. To the extent the MPRDA doesn't, we don't grant it. We believe we should tie it into the MPRDA. And the final one was the 100% write-off. The 100% write-off is not for oil and gas. Oil and, in the sense that you were expressing it, oil and gas will be charged a royalty. Every mineral that is transferred from this country will be charged a royalty. However, for purposes of the rate formula, you will get a deduction for your capital expenditure. All minerals get a deduction. And all minerals typically get 100% deduction. Oil and gas was funny, and it needed a special provision to get them the 100% deduction. But they get 100% deduction from that EBIT calculation. So in the early years, you will find that we probably won't be getting much of a royalty. But we always get a minimum 0.5, and then later years we'll pick up. But it's basically 100% write-off, not every year, just once. So if they spend $50 million on a rig, they will get a deduction for that rig over time. And that's all we're preserving. Now, if you look at the income tax, we don't give you 100%. We give you a 200% or a 150%. So this one was pulled back in line with the other minerals, basically. That's what we've done there.
Okay. Are there any further questions? Okay, can I take this opportunity to thank you, Keith, and your team for the hard work you've put into this, and trust that it will yield the results that are intended. Look forward to the implementation. So we'll wait for you to return to us for a formal consideration when the time comes. And I trust that this committee will do the right thing. Thank you very much. Perhaps to go back to the matter that we dealt with earlier with regard to the ratification of the double taxation agreement. I've since received a letter here from Mr. Thomasek, which reads as follows. Our apologies for the confusion on Brazil and India. These two agreements are mutual assistance agreements for customs and are not double taxation agreements. They are classified as administrative and technical agreements that fall under Section 231, Sub 3, and not Sub 2 that deals with the other. So if anybody has a constitution, if you could look at Sub 3 of the constitution. They are tabled for information after signature, and a briefing would be held only if requested by the committee. Mm. For the sake of completeness, the mutual assistance agreement with Brazil was signed on the 11th of May 2008 in Somerset West in the presence of Mr. Joking. It was in your constituency without your knowledge. And with India on the 22nd of February 2008 in Pretoria. This comes from Mr. Frank Tomczyk. I think the explanation is in order. Do you want to read? Read to us what Sub 3 says.
Sub 3 says international agreement. An international agreement of a technical, administrative, or executive nature, or an agreement which does not require either ratification or accession, entered into by the national executive, binds the republic without approval by the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces, but must be tabled in the Assembly and the Council within a reasonable time.
So it's a different arrangement. If members could just, I mean, for record purposes, I think we'll have acknowledge that, and thanks, we thank France for having dealt with the matter after the confusion. Okay, so that brings us to the end of the session. We meet again tomorrow for the seminar on on the report of the so-called Harvard group in E249. We have invited other, is it in the old assembly chamber? Yeah, old assembly chamber. We've invited other interested committees and whichever member of parliament is interested in this, it's a matter of public interest, is welcome. So that takes place tomorrow at 9:30 in the old assembly chamber. Bradley also informs me that there is no meeting on Friday.
Oh. Or the provincial congress?
What?
Our provincial congress.
Are you going to the provincial congress?
The week after.
There is lunch. Where is lunch? I'm told that there is lunch. It's on a square. Lunch is on a square.
Is that the one?